From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, Conversations and Comments, featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Following last week's discussion about the Gilded Age, the period in America from the end of the Civil War till roughly the turn of the 20th century, Soundings now continues that theme with a program about Henry Adams, the American historian who lived from 1838 till 1918. Adams is seen by many observers as a sort of intellectual and cultural weather vane of his times. Along with many of his fellow citizens, Henry Adams reacted to the enormous material developments of the Gilded Age with misgivings. He questioned the direction of American institutions, such as education and commerce, and wondered about religion in a time of increasing secularity. In the following discussion for Soundings, three scholars examine Henry Adams and his importance to American life during the Gilded Age. The panelists are Hiram Caton, Robert Terhorst, and Giles Gunn. Hiram Caton and Robert Terhorst recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Caton, who teaches at Griffith University in Australia, worked on a project entitled The Politics of Progress. Robert Terhorst, who teaches at the University of Arizona, worked on a forthcoming book entitled The Fortunes of the Novel. Giles Gunn is a professor of religion and American studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Hiram Caton.
Scholarship had been the prestige vocation in Western civilization for a long time and had been associated with the clergy, deeply associated with the clergy, and a scholar was a kind of spiritual mentor. But in the 1870s and 80s, tertiary education was transformed too by the impact of modern science. And Adams is saying, no, look, the Ford automobile and flying around in the Wright Brothers airplane does not make that much difference. We are still in this little envelope of life. And he generated a counter historiography, to come back to that point, of decline. He tried to show, on the basis of modern science, that in fact we're not progressing, we're in a retrograde motion. And he has a number of arguments to that effect, some of them drawn from the second law of thermodynamics to the from the argument from entropy and so on.
What's important about the fact that Adams became a historian? That he found in the writing of, what did he find in the writing of history that helped him at least confront, if not resolve, the spiritual tensions that he encountered in his own life? And that in turn leads to a larger question about his fascination with the Middle Ages. Why is that important in all of this mixture?
For me, one needs to see Adams as a belated romantic. What happens, at least in non-scientific areas, when one can no longer believe in the stories that religion adheres to about the origin and destiny of man, is that other stories, then other myths, need to come along to replace the lost myth, the myth in which you can no longer believe. And so we do see in the early Romantic period, in the early part of the 19th century, a marvelous proliferation of storytelling, of myth, of new myths. Poets, for example, are extraordinarily narrative. Byron is an example, but all continental poets have an addiction to narration, which we consider not characteristic or not inherently characteristic of poetry. More recognizable forms of narration, the novel, come into being. And above all, in the mind which can no longer happily live along with the old stories, new stories appear in the form of history. A person like Gibbon, I think, is basic to an understanding of this process. One has lost the old myth in the story of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. One has a new myth of a fall from grace or a fall from Eden. So Adams, I think, fits into this pattern. One reason he becomes a historian is that he's trying to find a new narration which will help to account for the human condition.
It seems to me that what Adams did realize.
I like
that,
Adam.
that's not bad. What Adams did realize is that organized religion, religion in any of its recognizably organized modes, was essentially dead. He realized this as a child, but he didn't come to understand what it meant until he was older. And what so both confused and surprised him is that this death occurred among the generation of his own parents and their peers, who were supposedly, at least within Boston society, one of the most learned and cultivated generations ever to appear. But religion died for them precisely because the old questions that religion was intended to address were of absolutely no interest to them. Questions having to do with the origin or destiny of life, questions having to do with the nature of evil and good.
Religion, I take it, had become what? A sort of a social function, and not much beyond that.
Quite so, and it had been made pallid when it was ever even a subject of discussion by virtue of the fact that that the strange and eccentric and sort of odd shapes and forms of Catholic Christianity had been diluted by a kind of a corpse cold Unitarianism. And nobody is more severe than in what price Christianity paid by being Unitarianized than Adams himself. But that's only the beginning. What Adams felt even more acutely, as Hiram said, was the enormous gulf that had opened up between the precepts by which even the generation of his own parents lived, with their attenuated relationship to Christian assumptions, and the new world in which he found himself entering, surely when he came back to America after the Civil War. This gulf had been opened up in many ways by the impact of what science had discovered. It had also been opened up by other things which had come into play, the commercialization of American life, which then got summarized in the catchphrase that Mark Twain devised for it called the Gilded Age. The way in which thought simply had been displaced in favor of energy in the person of somebody like Grant, who not only displaced thought for the sake of energy, but displaced principle as well. If he didn't, at least the people he surrounded himself did.
He didn't think about it.
That's right. In fact, what Adams essentially says is that he can't think.
Right. Ball of vibrating strings.
Right.
Or what is it Goethe said? There's nothing more frightful than ignorance in action.
In the face of these monumental changes that we've been talking about, Adams found all explanatory principles essentially useless. They didn't explain what it was that had happened, which was A, this immense change, and B, the move from what he sometimes calls a world which was unified, in the case of his forefathers and his parents' generation, by at least moral principles, 18th century moral principles, and the New World, where multiplicity, where whirl was king. What Adams therefore had to do was to find some way of explaining this and finding an order in it. He did so essentially by undergoing a kind of religious experience, at least as he writes about it in The Education, when in the Great Hall of Gallery of Dynamos at the Paris Exposition in 1900, he found himself in the presence of what he could only claim was a religious image or symbol, even a religious force, which he identified with the dynamo, and which he took to be a force whose momentousness could only be compared to that of the cross for the early Christians, and then proceeded to try to say that for the modern world, this was essentially the new religious symbol, insofar as it gathered together all of the forces that had been unleashed by the Industrial Revolution and the Technological Revolution and the Scientific Revolution. And then he attempted to try to explain what it would mean to think of this image as our new religious symbol, not acknowledged officially as such, but
that's precisely the crunch. that a dynamo should be a religious symbol is the great paradox, because it to the eyes of most of the world, the dynamo is a symbol of a new scientific, technological, wholly secular force. And Adams' attempt to revive religion, to recover spirituality in the modern age, does indeed turn upon being able to see these new forces, scientific, technological, commercial, as being some apparently secular covering for a hidden spiritual message. And then if he can succeed in doing that, if he can find spirit amidst those things, then he can hope to bring it out and reinvigorate some sort of cult around that discovery. And what, by pairing the Virgin and the dynamo in that famous passage in the Education of Henry Adams, I think that is one of the central places where he invites the reader and himself to play with the possibility that there is a spirituality in modern physics. Now, this leads him into what one might call a philosophy of science, whereby he attempts to interpret the new physics, which was the physics of subatomic particles, particle physics, as emanations from the divine substance. He actually says that. Let me read you a quote. "The rays of physics were a revelation of mysterious energy like that of the cross. They were what, in terms of medieval science," he means medieval metaphysics, "were called immediate modes of divine substance." Now, that is one of the numerous passages in which he plays with the possibility that modern physics could be reinterpreted in some sort of spiritual mode, where spirit is basically nailed down in the medieval epoch. People were playing around with the possibility of a rapprochement between science and religion.
Yeah, in Comte, right at the beginning of the century.
Well, but Comte, that's true, of course, but there were much later precedents, and one of these individuals was a famous physicist who contributed to thermodynamic theory, as a matter of fact, Pierre Duhem, who was a devout Catholic. Now, Duhem would have been horrified at Adam's way of going about this rapprochement, because for Duhem, you had to keep religion and science completely separate. Duhem's position was basically a kind of fetism, but it was a fetism with a sting in the tail, because what he says, as speaking as a physicist or a philosopher of science, is that physics doesn't really know, science doesn't really know anything but appearances. What we do is describe. We don't know what the actual nature of things is.
First causes.
If you say that, if you make that move, then you leave it open the possibility that some medieval scholasticism does know first causes. Right? Mm-hmm. The medieval age, by contrast, is one can look nostalgically at it because that was an age of unity. He always contrasts medieval period unity there as distinguished from modern discontinuity, incoherence, disunity.
Hiram, I would just want to ask you, though, whether you think that that Adams was attempting to try to turn the religion of the dynamo, or the mm-hmm. at least the religious power he saw invested in the image of the dynamo, into a new kind of cult. Beyond that, whether you feel that that Adams was in fact interested in, as we're now talking about it, correlating religion and science, it seems to me that he was very suspicious of that. That in fact, what he believed to the very end of his life was that all the theories advanced, even by science, to explain the nature of experience or nature itself, were unprovable and probably wrong. In any case, what he said at the very end of the education was that that if nature abhors anything, it's not a vacuum, it's rather the imposition of any kind of artificial order on it. And the order, the only order that he saw nature finally exhibiting was a kind of chaotic order.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second of two discussions about America during the Gilded Age, the period between the end of the Civil War and the turn of the 20th century. The topic is Henry Adams, the American historian, considered by many critics to be one of the central intellectual and cultural figures of the Gilded Age. The panelists are Hiram Caton, Giles Gunn, and Robert Terhorst. Hiram Caton and Robert Terhorst recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Terhorst of the University of Arizona worked on his forthcoming book entitled The Fortunes of the Novel. Professor Caton of Griffith University in Australia worked on a project entitled The Politics of Progress. Giles Gunn teaches religion and American studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is Hiram Caton.
There is a struggle going on in Adams' mind that we see displayed in the education of Henry Adams, a struggle of a humanist, a scholar, historian, with these momentous new forces. Now, the character of that struggle is Adams' attempt to retrieve spirit, longing for immortality, religion, from the apparent debris, the total collapse of religious belief under this momentous intellectual structure. In order to do that, then, he must find a way of defeating intellectually, at least in his terms, he must intellectually defeat this threat to spirit. In the end, therefore, the spiritual forces from the primitive religious urge in man is going to be higher than physics. Okay, theology is higher than physics. That's what it's got to come out to be. Ultimately, our knowledge, our temperamental disposition, our emotional disposition, or Adams, must make him a religious man as distinguished from a secular man. So it's a kind of gestalt switch that he's trying to achieve. How do you regard this modern secular culture in such a way as to see the religious dimension of it without, for all that, trying to subvert the obvious secular face of it? You're not going to try to change its surface.
Or identifying yourself with what you take to be its religious dimension.
Right, right.
See, would you put it? Could we put it this way? That Adams remains a religious man, a spiritual man, in the sense that he continues to look for those images of order, both in his own experience, his own historical experience as an Adams, but also in his experience as a modern man, mm-hmm. and can find some, in the case of the dynamo, images which present themselves as images of total order, but not images to which he can then give his worship.
But he does say things such as, if we are obliged to insist upon a universe, and that's what Adams is obliged to do, we seem to be driven to the church. Now, I submit it's really quite an unusual thing for a New England Protestant or man with a New England Protestant background to become seriously engaged with medieval culture. That was worse than a son turning Turk to turn Catholic, because the tradition holds, of course, that the Pope is Antichrist and so on. Now, for Adams, return to the medieval age was not directly through medieval theology, although he did take that seriously, but through art. And that's the famous study of Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres. It is there that he first attempts to find unity. Look at the work. Compare the work of the medieval period
the cathedral, the Gothic cathedral, with the work of a modern age, a dynamo or a factory or an airplane or whatever it may be. And he, in comparing these two cultures, he finds a spirituality, a strength, a depth, a unity in the medieval period that he thinks is missing in the modern. Indeed, I read The Education of Henry Adams as a mortification, as a Christian mortification. The whole presentation of himself as a failure, the debunking of his intellectuality is, I believe, a flagellation of intellectual pride, where that is quite pertinent to his point, because the sense of the modern secular man is precisely pride of intellect. Look at what we can do, these physicists and technicians. That's that notion that we have nature by the throat, the conquest of nature, in Bacon's proud Lord Chancellorial phrase. That pride has to be tamed in order to become a confessing Christian. I believe Adams was quite right about that. It represents a depth of insight in him that he recognized that to be serious about spirituality, in the sense I've been using that term, one had to tame that modern pride of intellect.
Charles, let me ask you to comment on how ideas such as this infinite complexity, this lack of conclusion, the search for unity, what kind of a response did that find in the churches of the time that Adams lived? Did anybody really pay any attention to him in that sense? Did he have any impact on religious thinking in America?
No, he didn't, and hasn't yet.
Maybe soon.
he was simply ignored?
Essentially, yes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, very few people still read the Education of Henry Adams, for example, much less Mont-Saint-Michel and Chartres, as documents that are very important in the attempt to try to explore the crises and dimensions of belief, either in some other time or in our own. Yet there is a kind of interesting paradox, Hiram, because nonetheless, Adams, the cast of Adams' mind, indeed its very texture, has many marked affinities with other kinds of religious thinking, not so much that are expressed in the popular dimensions of cultural life, but at least in our religious traditions, from Puritanism to the present. I'm thinking in particular of the doubleness of his thinking. We've talked about his emphasis upon things like disjunction and contradiction and inconsistency and so on. But there is in Adams this fascination with the two-sidedness of things, multiplicity and unity, and so on. And that kind of almost Manichaean way of thinking in black and white, in oppositions, is very like the kind of mind that a critic like Richard Chase would say characterizes the American novel, for example, which is also fascinated with contradictions and tends to rest in extreme versions of experience.
The one great thing missing in Adams in that respect, Giles, is the absence of a sense of sin and guilt. We have mortification, but it is not a sense of moral guilt. There's no, that's completely missing. If we look at Puritan preaching, one very important trope there that repeats itself again and again is the Jeremiad, this notion of overwhelming sinfulness, overwhelming incapacity to live our lives according to the dictates of the scriptures, and so we are in a veil of sorrow and tears, and we seek for a divine forgiveness to come back up to a level acceptable in the eyes of the Lord. Now that's wholly missing in Henry Adams.
But I don't know if it's missing. It's the but I think you're talking about the Puritan conscience.
Well, yes,
in part. You know, I mean that sin is an element in it. But I think it may be more deeply hidden.
What did Adams say, for instance, about redemption and Christ? Did he accept Christ, for instance, the way a medieval Catholic would have? He makes a lot out of the image of the Virgin.
It's interesting that Christ is not the central figure mm-hmm. for him, that the Virgin is. Well, medieval Christianity was many, many things. It was heresies and orthodoxies, and the orthodoxies were not, there was no agreement on what the orthodoxy was after all the theologians quarreled.
But one big thing it was Mariolatry, so yes. Adams here is in a major, is connecting with a major current in Catholicism,
absolutely.
Really, of all
well,
times.
If he has this hunger after belief, a supernatural belief,
yeah.
why is he silent on such an issue so central to Christianity as Christ himself?
Well, he's not hungry after righteousness. I would just set that down to Henry Adams' temperament. It's what he was, mm-hmm. and I find absent in his work a sense of sin. But there is something related to it which could be mistaken for it, and which is, I've called this self-mortification, mm-hmm. the humbling of a pride. But it proceeds very much on an intellectual level, and we don't see Henry Adams agonizing about his conduct. Does he anywhere?
Oh, well, I think so. The devastating blow of his wife's suicide, that's why I speak of the depth of the concealment.
I see.
Which, of course, is related to this whole address to the feminine. If one wanted to play Dr. Freud with Henry Adams, I think one would look to his mother to try to seek a partial explanation, and it could only be partial, of this overwhelming adhesion to the feminine, but also the annihilating experience of his wife's suicide, and the St. Gordon statue, for example, which is an empty statue. I think there is a tremendous trauma connected with the feminine in Adams.
I think you're right, mm. Hiram, that he doesn't hunger after righteousness, mm. but that has a great deal to do with the fact that he is a child of the 18th century. What he did hunger after was being of service. And what he found is that history would not allow him to be of service,
yes.
and for that reason he felt like he was a failure, and
yes.
that's where the theme of self-mortification comes.
But you see, he was, as Robert has said, a gentleman. He had a sense of his worth. And
he felt a category of service, is
yes,
that it?
Let's call him an aristocrat, to put mm-hmm. it right out in the open. And it's part of being an aristocrat, this noblesse oblige, the sense of being able to render a service to others is essential mm-hmm. to one's sense of self as an aristocrat. This is visible. This is not an idiosyncrasy of Henry Adams. There have been a number of great American families who have felt this sense of service, who are our, we call them the plutocrats or the blue bloods or the Boston Brahmins and what have you. Very deeply ingrained in families, they want to be able to serve the public in conspicuous offices. Henry Adams was not able to do that temperamentally.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the second of two discussions about American society during the Gilded Age. The topic was Henry Adams. The panelists were Hiram Caton of Griffith University, Giles Gunn of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona. Professors Terhorst and Caton recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Next week on Soundings, a discussion entitled The Hospital in History. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.